Let's have an AA meeting. My name is Misty and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year more sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. We hope that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them, and I must have this thing. I get the pleasure tonight of introducing the most sharpest-dressed man in this room. You guys, he's got a sobriety date of 7/21/2009. I couldn't do the math, so 14 years he celebrated a few days ago, all the way from living in the solution group in Roswell, Tom B.
An alcoholic's dream come true, a room full of people and a microphone. So there were lots of bandanas missing at the convenience store to make this story. I'm Tom, I'm an alcoholic. And like was mentioned, my sobriety date is July 21st, 2009. I've got a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor, and I believe his sponsor has a sponsor as well. They're not in the room tonight. I don't see them, so I must not be loved. And if anyone laughs at that joke, you'll know what I'm talking about. But I do. I sponsor other men in the program. I work AA's 12 steps. I've done that a number of times. And I also do some other recovery work. You know, I've heard speakers come up and talk, and they talk about, you know, their childhood was perfect. They didn't see anybody drink. Nothing went wrong. This is not my story. I mean, this is not what happened to me. And like was talked about before, was our stories disclosed in a general way, what we were like, what it was like and what we were like now. Just a little background on me, just to give you an idea of the person that walked through these doors 14 years ago. You know, when I grew up, I never, you know, alcoholism was a pastime sport in our family. I'm proud to say I've come from many devoted alcoholics. So much so that most of them have died from this disease. And in our book, it talks about, you know, sometimes it's not an easy choice living a spiritual life or dying an alcoholic death. And when you read over that line in alcoholic death, believe me, an alcoholic death is not very pretty. It's very slow. It's very painful. It's very painful for everyone around. But in growing up, I never met my grandfather from my mother's side. He died well before I was born. He was fought in World War II in the Pacific side, because they're from Alabama, so most people from the South went to the Pacific side of the war. He suffered from PTSD, and he was sent to rehab many, many times by his employer. And I found out from my uncle later on that he had committed suicide. I never met my grandmother from my mom's side until I was 6 years old. She just showed up one day, and this is how it worked in my family. Your grandmother just shows up. But she had been, after she had given up my mom and my uncles and aunts to her sisters, and they raised them. And then she shows up one day after battling alcohol for a number of years on her side. And I never saw her go to AA, but she never drank again. She read a lot of books. She loved Jesus, and she always told me she loved me. She smoked and drank a lot of coffee. But I just never, you know, it was just weird meeting this person. On the other side, my father's side, my grandfather was the typical binge drinker. And for whatever reason, my family, early age, would send me off to stay with my grandparents. And my grandfather was, you could read about him in the book. He would start with a six-pack of beer, and then a six-pack and a pint, then a six-pack of tall boys and a pint, and then whatever, 750 milliliters and a six-pack. And then it would crescendo with him getting sick for like 4 or 5 days and swearing to my grandmother he was never drinking again. And then 2 weeks later, our Sunday would start with, we lived in a dry county. So it would be, let's take a drive to see the airplanes take off. And we would drive across to the next county, get a six-pack, and it would just start all over again. And he later, when I was in high school, he died of this disease. And watching that happen was tough. The other thing that happened in my childhood was when I was 3 years old, my brother died in front of me, in front of my mom, and in front of my grandparents. And seeing that kind of play out and watching that happen, I don't think I processed that trauma very well. I don't think my mom ever processed that trauma. And I know my grandparents didn't. I remember my father later on in life would say things like, if I was only there, I could have saved him. And my brother, basically, he suffered from epilepsy. But they just didn't know at that time when he had an episode, how to take care of it, and he ended up dying. And, the term alcoholic was used as a bad word in my family growing up, especially if my grandmother got really mad at my grandfather, he was an alkie or an alcoholic. And no one else ever mentioned the word. No one ever mentioned about stop drinking or anything like that. There was always drinking going on in the family. If everyone got together, there was drinking. Monday through Friday through Saturday through Sunday, there was always drinking. Didn't matter if it was a funeral, didn't matter if it was a birthday party, promotion, lost a job, you had to drink. So it was just part of my culture. I really didn't see anything, different about that. I remember my uncle, when he retired and sold his business, and my dad went into business with him, his drinking got really, really, really bad. And just a few years earlier, my grandfather had died at his house from drinking too much. But no one would say anything like, you got to stop drinking. I remember it was his friends that intervened, but not the family that intervened. And I think the family just had the attitude of, we just didn't talk about alcoholism. As a kid growing up, I can remember one time my grandparents' friends came over. And for one time, they weren't drinking. They were drinking coffee, and they had this book, and they were talking real quiet and serious. And I think maybe that one time my grandfather might have been introduced to AA, but it never stuck. It never took in that respect. It was just crazy times. Just crazy, crazy times. No one really talked about anything. I had an uncle who was very mean to his kids, and, no one talked about what went on or what happened or anything like that. It was just, everything was just kind of put under the rug. And I think, looking back on it now, I kind of see that's how people in my family dealt with things, was we didn't talk about pains or traumas or what was wrong. We just drank the pain away and just ignored it. And then, also my father, in growing up into my teen years, he was a very difficult person. The description of irritable, discontent was the idea of my father. I mean, I waited as a child, it was on pins and needles when he got out of the car, what was going to happen in the house. And growing up in that type of an environment, really put a shock to my system. I would say that, I had to behave really good for mom, because if mom was upset, then he would use that as an excuse to take it out on me. And this kind of behavior went on even into high school. And I remember one time he got mad at me when he was in the garage about something, I don't know about what, and he took a 7-iron and he hit me as hard as he could. And across the arm, and it put the 7-iron mark across my bicep. And I remember I played football at the time, and football was a great sport for me because I had, unbeknownst to me, a lot of anger issues. But I could get that out in that type of environment. But I remember the coach coming up to me and going, what the hell is that? And I remember going, don't say anything. It was my fault. My dad got mad at me. And I remember, I was kind of had that attitude of like, don't tell, keep things quiet. I can manage it. Everything will be fine. And about this time was the time I started drinking. And I was, you know, I didn't think I had a problem because I could say to people with all the honesty in my heart, you know, I'm not an alcoholic. If you want to see an alcoholic, just come to my house. I'll show you what real drinking looks like. You know, I could always compare very easily with that. And, you know, my coach, when I was 16 years old, during two-a-day football practices, I was throwing up during two-a-days. And he comes over to me and he says, you know, and he uses my last name, and I won't use it here, but he says, he goes, you know, if you didn't drink like an alcoholic, you wouldn't throw up like this. And I thought to him, I literally was like, what is he talking about? What? I'm not an alcoholic. You should see the people at my house. I'm the casual drinker around here. And I was also, you know, I should have known I had a problem when I was 16 and my friends came up to me and said, hey, you know, you're the only one with your own flask with your initials on it. You know, and that's, you know, and I was like, what are you talking about? You know, you can't just drink beer. You got to have something to mix with, you know, something a little stronger. So that was kind of, you know, this was kind of the attitude, you know, I brought into all this. And another vivid memory I had in my childhood was my father had left his career in sales, and was a very proud career in sales, and he'd gone into business with my uncle, and my uncle had his alcoholism had gotten really bad. I remember every night my father would drink himself in his chair, just drink himself to pass out, and he would just be in there crying about how my uncle had ruined his life with his drinking. If my uncle would just stop his drinking, his life would be perfect. And I remember thinking, just seeing that, you know, going, that's such a weird concept. But anyway, so, and I'll get to that in a minute here, just kind of how things go through this. But, you know, in high school, drinking was really the only way to kind of manage my feelings. When I started drinking, everything felt okay. I could talk to other people. I did not feel as though I was bad. You know, my parents put me in school a year earlier. So my wife, who we are the same age, she was a year younger than me in school. And all of her friends were my age. But I was constantly being told, every year these teachers would come in and say, he needs to stay back a year. And my parents would say things like, my kid is not going to fail this grade. And I would be told, you got to work harder, try harder. And my brain just couldn't think at that speed at the time. And for like the first time, I was just part of the group now. I was not less than, I was not greater than, I was just okay being me. And I was, you know, I probably never felt that in my life. And I graduated high school by the seat of my pants. A lot of my friends went to college. I did not. There was just no way. I went to junior college. Tried to, at least. My father, you know, one good thing, he pushed me really, really, really hard. So I went into the working field in sales early on. And I remember before I was 21, I had moved out, had my own place, and I was working with other people in their like 20s and 30s in this insurance sales. And, but I remember getting up every morning going, you know, I'm going to outwork everybody. I'm going to do it better than anybody else. No one's going to stop me. And it was like I was getting up in the morning looking at myself, you know, saying, good morning, opponents. You know, let's go down and fight my way through. You know, that's just kind of how I approached life. I was just going to you know, if it got hard, I was just going to lean in harder. I could also, my magic formula at the time was, you know, I had, you know, I could control my drinking, you know, so I had a 12-pack in the fridge, and so I could control my drinking. So, you know, I could party, and the industry I was in was, you know, everyone drinking insurance sales. So it was just, you know, going out for cocktails at lunch, it was perfect. I had gotten married early to my high school sweetheart. I got married when I was 25. We bought a place together, we moved in, and literally the first week I came home with a 12-pack of beer, and I go to put it in the fridge, and she goes, what are you doing? And I go, I'm putting beer in the fridge. And she's like, you're not going to drink it, are you? And I'm like, well, of course I'm going to drink it. This is what you do. She said, no, you don't drink every day. And that was the first time I'd ever heard anybody say that. Like, I said, what do you mean you don't drink every day? She's like, we're not drinking every day. And I was like, oh. And so I think that was kind of the start of my self-deception. You know, maybe the split, maybe where my alcoholic thinking started going, because, you know, I started this pattern of planning and hiding and lying about my drinking. You know, okay, I can't drink at home. So, hey, honey, we got a business meeting after at 5 o'clock, and it just happens to be at Chili's or whatever it was. And, you know, and how many beers are you going to have? I want to have one beer. Well, I don't know if you remember Chili's to sell those, you know, 1 liter beers. Well, I just had two. And that was the start of that type of, you know, attitude. One time, you know, and there were many, many, many signs I had problems. There was Florida State lost to Miami, first wide right. I don't know if anyone remembers that. But I was having a party at the house, and, of course, there was a lot of drinking. And by the end of the night, it ended up with, you know, my wife sleeping in the house, and then the rest of the people and us guys on a dare streaking across the street. You know, this is at 10 o'clock at night in a neighborhood. And the cops getting called and chasing us. And I remember, you know, there were these four cop cars pulling up over the median and us running into the house. And I was the last one. And as my three naked friends, who, you know, and three of them played college football offensive, like big guys, you know, run in. And I remember turning around and seeing these, like, five or six police officers running full speed at my door. And I remember thinking, oh, this is my house. They're going to break my door down. I'm going to open the door. And then I remember thinking, hey, they can't come in my house. And I remember pushing this one policeman into the group. And then as I was pushing him, I remember thinking, this is a bad idea. This is a bad idea. It was a bad idea. And I remember a bunch of them jumping off of me. But the end of the story is I started to try to convince everybody that it was all their fault that this happened to me and that they needed to kick in some money so I can get an attorney and fight the charge. You know, I got to fight the man because, you know, I was wrongly convicted. But that was just my thinking. You know, I was the victim in this. That was, you know, but that was just my pattern of thinking that I just, this was my magic formula at the time. A few years later, not a few years later, about 10 years later, we had our first child. I decided to go back into the family business. This is where, you know, my self-deception was starting to kick in pretty bad. I thought I could manage my drinking. Starting out every day with a handful of Advil and looking in the mirror, saying good morning, opponents, and having to take the Advil just to say it, you know. It's getting old. But the thing that really struck me was my father's drinking was getting really, really, really bad. All the promises he made were just going out the window and all these things were happening. It was just pure chaos. And I remember I think I was at my mom's house or something, drinking in her hot tub, crying that my father was ruining my life with his drinking. And it didn't hit me until like afterwards. It was like, I'm doing the same freaking thing. Here I am following the same pattern of it's, you know, not my fault. And that was, you know, that was kind of the start of it. And, you know, when my father went into, he got admitted and involuntarily admitted. I remember people came to me like, hey, you need to help your dad out. You need to help your dad out. You know, take him to some meetings. I remember thinking, oh, yeah, I'll take my dad. I'll show him how easy this is. I'll take him to some meetings. And we went to a bunch of newcomer meetings. And I remember listening, you know, going, this is going to be good for him, right? This is going to be really good for him. But I remember people talking in these newcomer meetings, what it was like, how they thought about their drinking, their attitudes toward their drinking. And I remember listening, going, gosh, that sounds a lot like me. You know, that's how I think about my drinking. I didn't realize, you know, there's healthy ways and unhealthy ways of thinking about it. You know, and that's how sick I was, too, that, you know, let me show you. You go get straightened up so my life will be easier, okay? This is how sick I was. And I remember this nurse, I was running around the hospital asking these doctors, how do I get a better, how do I get a better? This nurse whispers, you should go to Al-Anon, right? So I go to Al-Anon. And I go to a newcomer meeting in Al-Anon. And they hand out the, you know, thing. Read the steps, the same steps we got up here. And it was my turn, and it was the first step. And I couldn't get the first step out of my mouth without bawling my brains out, because that was the truest thing I had honestly said. It was the first time I was honest with a group of people that, you know, admitted I was powerless over alcohol and that my life had become unmanageable. It was truly that way. And I remember that night, I went to dinner with my wife, and I started playing the game again. Oh, are you going to have a glass of wine? Because if you're going to have a glass of wine, I might have two glasses of wine. So maybe we should just go ahead and get the bottle and blah, blah. And I'm going through this charade with her. And she just goes, what if all those people that were sitting in that room that you were just crying, you couldn't get step one out of your mouth, walked in this door and saw you drinking wine? What are you saying to them? How honest, were you honest back there? And I was like, she kicked me in the balls. You know, let's be honest, it was true. You know, I'm sitting there playing one hand, alcohol's ruining my life, and on the other hand, I'm trying to medicate the hell out of my life by just drinking as much as I can. So, as God would have it, and I'm not, you know, I gotta tell you, before I came into AA, I had long ago given up on the power, or the idea of God. But just how kind of God works in our lives. I had gone, come back home, and my neighbor had just gotten back from California. He had just gotten a DUI, and his wife told him that if he didn't go to AA, she was going to leave him. So he comes over and says, hey, will you help me out? I'm like, yeah, what? He's like, hey, will you go to AA with me on Sunday nights? I'm like, yeah, I've been to a few meetings. I'll go with you. I can help you out. I can help you out. So I started going to this, it was started by Sandy Beach. Anybody knows who Sandy Beach is? Men's Black Belt group on Sunday night. You had to check in. And these guys were brutal. You sat around a room and you checked in. Did you do this? Did you do that? Did you meet with your sponsor? Did you drink? Did you read AA literature? Did you call them? Did you help another person? And for the first time in my life, I saw a group of men actually keeping commitments. I didn't know what that looked like. You know, I didn't know what it looked like to keep a commitment, to keep your word. I was like, you know, I'm here to help Duff. But then I could kind of see what AA looked like, because I did not believe people when they said I hadn't had a drink in 30 years. Like, I thought that was a lie. You know, they were just, because I had never seen it in my life. And I couldn't comprehend it. So about a week later, my last drink was, we had taken the kids over to Disney. The wife and the little kids were at the pool. And I say to my wife, oh, do you want a drink? She's like, well, yeah, I'll have a pina colada. I said, okay, I'll go get you one. So go get her one, and go have a couple of drinks at the bar, go get a beer. By the time I get back, I'm like, oh, look, my beer's out. I got to go get another one. And I had honestly said to myself, honestly, and before this time too, a number of times, yeah, I'm just going to have one, or I promise I won't drink more than two and come home completely yes-faced. But this time, when I left her and had gone to a couple of AA meetings, I said, yeah, I'll be right back. And literally, in my mind, it was 5 minutes. Apparently, it was like an hour. And there she is at the front of this bar at Disney, at the hotel, holding all three kids, going, hey, you said you'd be right back. It's been an hour. And everyone at the bar starts laughing and slapping me on the back. Ha, 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 ha. And I go back, and I'm walking. She's like, you did it again. You did it again. I'm sitting there going, gosh, you know, it's not my fault, you know. And I get back, and the next morning we get up, handful of Advil. We get up, and as we're walking to breakfast with the kids, we have to walk past the pool, and we have to walk past the same bar. And my littlest, who is probably 3 years old at the time, she has a happy or a binky in her mouth. She pops her binky out and goes, look, Mom, there's where all of Dad's friends live. She's pointing toward the bar. And my wife just looks at me and just goes, out of the mouths of babes. And she was totally right. That was my kid's perception of me. It was, there's Dad living in the bar. And that was the first time I actually saw myself through them. And that was the last time I drank. So I kept going to this meeting with my friend, Duff, who is, he's not sober anymore. But that's another story. And man, you know, I've learned a lot in this program. But I kept going to this men's black belt group, and I learned some things. I heard some things in there that just were new concepts to me altogether. One was, you know, my intentions are not my actions. you know, in my family, you couldn't be mad at us because I really didn't mean to hit you over the head with a frying pan or shoot a gun at you or stab you with a knife. It was, you know, it wasn't my intention, you know, so you can't blame me. The first time I had heard those were different things was a new concept to me. It was honestly a new concept to me. I learned what a commitment meant, like, you know, to keep your word and not to follow through with it. I remember I was seeing a therapist every week, and I remember crying every week when I was talking to my therapist about this. And I said, what am I crying about? And he goes, you're actually grieving the loss of giving or saying goodbye to the only thing that's given you any comfort in your life, drinking.
Wow.
I never thought of it that way, you know, because I was just considering picking up a white chip. I did end up picking up a white chip, you know, and I got a sponsor right away. They didn't sponsor. You know, he suggested, look, I want you to go to 90 and 90. And I was like, okay, you know. And I fought with him. You know, you don't know how important I am. I'm really busy. I can't go to 90 and 90. You know, what I remember is like, well, if you want to do this thing, you're going to go to, you want me as your sponsor, you're going to go to 90 and 90. I'm like, oh, I'll go to 90 and 90. I remember walking into a meeting, and there was this guy standing out in front of the meeting that I knew. And he comes, he's like, hey, man, how you doing? Are you doing great? I'm glad to be here. It's 8 a.m., man. Isn't it hot, man? Isn't this great? And I just looked at him. I was probably my first 3 days, and I'm like, no. And he goes, what are you talking about? I go, Jeff, I'm suffering. And it was the first time I think I was honest with somebody about how I was feeling. I wasn't putting on that fake, you know, everything's great, everything's wonderful, everything's fun. You know, I was like, no, I'm just suffering, man. I don't know what's going to happen next. Because I could always drink and get rid of those feelings. I was stuck with my feelings. I remember going to a newcomers meeting in my 90 and 90. They put all the newcomers had to sit at the front of the room. And you had to share. They get around to me. And I, you know, I'm a big shot. You know, I flew in on a plane just to be here. And they're like, so what's going on? I don't know, man. And I got to paint this picture real quick. I love this. Love this story. And the newcomers, they go around and pass the basket, right? And this girl goes, I'm going to pick up a chip tonight. And they're like, oh, really? Why? She goes, well, when you guys said 30 days, I thought it meant at night I could drink. And I'm sitting there in my mind just going, what are you, stupid? You know, and I'm sitting there so angry. Kids to me is like, what do you want? I said, I don't know. I'm still like, I'm angry. And this guy in the back of the room, this is a newcomers meeting. All the old timers get to share and tell you what's going on with you. He's like, you're in fear. I go, fear? I'll show you some damn fear. You're going to see some fear world meet on the parking lot. But no, but that was my first reaction. You know, I was learning to be honest. I was learning to feel my feelings without medicating them to death. Some of you are laughing. You do probably recognize, you know, experience some of this. But I will say this. This, you know, step one for me was a feeling of, you know, I started in my mind, I learned to take an inventory of how much time I spent actually drinking, planning my drinking, hiding my drinking, and recovering from my drinking. And when I took that inventory, it was a whole nother life. And I felt like in the movie, It's a Wonderful Life. I felt like Jimmy Stewart in A Wonderful, at the end, where he's like, Zuzu's Medals, and it's this old house, and I was like, holy shit, if I do this thing, I've been given a whole other life. And that was my pink cloud experience with that. Was like, if I just get rid of this idea, man, I got all this other time. I did, my third step experience was a great experience. I had a sponsor who did not baby feed me. He was the sponsor that he would like, oh, you want to swim? Pushed me into the pool. So, of course, you know, in AA, we all hear this, but famous last words, I've got this. 3 months into sobriety, and I'm working through this, doing my inventory. I've got this. Yeah, this is easy, you know. We decided to go back to Disney to the Epcot Food and Wine Festival, you know, July 24th, 3 months, October 24th, my birthday. We're going to go to a bunch of places where people get drunk all day. But I've got this. And we went with this other couple that we knew well. And this other guy starts going, Are you sure you're an alcoholic? You just can't have one drink? These are called friends, by the way, in the outside world. But I'm like, I'm sitting there thinking, now I've had enough meetings to go, this is not helping. This is not an encouraging thing, because I've seen people get really bad. Plus, I've seen what's happened in my own family. And I got really, really squirrely. Really, really squirrely. I remember I called my sponsor, and he picked up the phone and he said, did you drink yet? And I was like, no, no, Marty. He's like, okay, great. This is great. He goes, you called me before you drank. Do you want to drink? I said, you know, I'm getting squirrely, man. I'm getting really squirrely. Everyone here, it felt like I was the only person at Epcot not drinking. And everyone was going, are you sure you can't have one? That's how I felt. And he's like, great, you're at step three. Why don't you stop and pray to whatever higher power you think it is and just ask for some help. And I stopped, and I remember my kids went and got these little Japanese owls. And they were little at the time. And these little things, and one was supposed to be for peace and serenity. And one of my daughters came up and said, this is for serenity, Dad, rub this. And I was like, that was the answer to my prayer. You know, they actually cared about me. You know, that was a cool thing. And I got through it. I didn't drink it. That's hot food wine. I never went back with that couple again, ever. You know, my four-step inventory, if some of you haven't done it, please do. And I will tell you, I heard a speaker say, and I truly believe this, doing your first fourth step is like giving a kindergartner some crayons and a white piece of paper. It's not going to look good the first time. That was my experience. It was, I think I had like 60 things on it. 58 of them were bullshit. The last two were what was really going on. This is what was happening. It was like a bad liar covering his tracks. But I've done, you know, inventories afterwards. But yeah, you know, and in the first couple of years when I got here, I was still, you know, I was still kind of crazy. I would go in, I was in the middle of this business deal, and I'd go into the 7 a.m. meeting 4 days a week, and I would just take my little tale of woe, my wet log, and throw it on their fire of serenity. And the smoke would billow in the room. And, you know, it was a bunch of old-timers. This one guy, he would just sit there and nod his head and nod his head. And one day he gave me this book, and it was A New Pair of Glasses by Chuck C. And I said, oh, yeah, thanks, man. Yeah, I'll read it. I'll read it, you know. And a few months later, this guy, he passed away. And, died in a... he was going to have just a typical heart procedure, died on the table. And one of his friends came up and said, Brian asked if you would be his pallbearer, one of his pallbearers. So I said, yeah, absolutely. You know, whatever they ask you to do, hey, you do. Did the pallbearer thing and went to his funeral. The next day I started reading that book. And in that book was my little tale of woe from Chuck C. about Chuck's business deal. It was the exactly the same deal. And the solution was in it, too. But that guy didn't tell me the solution. He had enough grace and love to say, I hear what you're saying. There happens to be an answer here. So if anyone ever suggests you read something in AA, they might be trying to hint. There might be, you know, your answer might be in there. And I learned some humility in that situation. I learned how to treat other people. I didn't have to give them the answer all the time. Another thing, too, is like when I first got here, I started going to this Living in the Solution North, and we would end with the back of the book, A Vision for You. And I remember, like, the first couple of meetings, you know, and I got a sponsor. My sponsor, you know, Tim knows him, Walker knows him, my guests. And I said to Mike after one of the meetings, you know, the line, and we trudged the road of happy destiny. I remember I got enough courage up after a few weeks, and I go, man, maybe we should make a change. You know, like that word trudge, that's such a boring word. Maybe we come up with another word. He goes, like, look, you dummy, it's out of the big book. Really? But here I was going to fix the meeting. So, yeah, I had to learn a lot of things in recovery. That was a lot of them. Humility was one of them. You know, I heard in here that when we get here, we throw in the towel, and then we spend the rest of the time pulling the towel back. That's been my experience as well, too. I think I surrendered a lot when I first came in, but slowly over time, I think I still wanted to get my way in a lot of areas. And when they didn't happen, I could get, you know, off the beam. You know, this program has just kind of taught me again and again that, you know, if I'm disturbed, the spiritual axiom, there's something wrong with me. You know, my father died in 2018 of this disease, and, you know, my brother called, and the, you know, of course the family was a little bit of a mess. And my brother didn't want to speak. None of the other family members wanted to speak at the funeral. And but my dad had very specific plans, you know, he wanted to do. So I remember, like, hey, I'm gonna give the talk. It's gonna be, I'm gonna talk about alcohol, my recovery, and tell my story, But that's a typical alcoholic. You heard the term, who's, the only person who's jealous of the person in the casket is an alcoholic because, the attention's not on them. I was in it. And I remember the night before, I called my sponsor. I said, this is what I'm thinking about doing. He's like, why don't you pray about it? And I prayed about it. And in this idea, he's like, why don't I take a gratitude list? And I started writing things I was grateful for about my father. And I thought it was going to be like three things, I got like three pages and I was bawling my brains out. And the next day I was able to get up and talk about in front of all of his friends in his world what I was grateful for. And really start to do the mourning process in a healthy way and look at things that way. And that would have never happened without AA. I had to start learning how to. I had a lot of resentments. And I didn't get the idea of making amends and having resentments against people and making your side of amends. I didn't get it until I started doing it. And what I experienced was by me learning how to forgive somebody or actually say I was sorry for my part in it, I was learning how to forgive myself because I had never internally experienced that. And by letting those people go, I was able to get some freedom in between my ears, and I wasn't always trying to figure things out. And that would have been impossible without AA. And that experience itself was, that's a whole new experience. A few years back, my daughter's cheerleader coach committed suicide. And I remember it brought up a lot of feelings in me and all the hopes and prayers and stuff, but I didn't feel that way. I didn't want to lie, but it got me to dig a little bit deeper about loss again. And then just a couple of years ago, right after COVID, one of my son's best friend committed suicide. I think the way I approached that was a lot different because I was willing to dig into the feelings about my daughter's coach that had happened. And I remember crying with the dad, just bawling with the father. I didn't tell him that everything was going to be okay. I just cried with him. And I don't think I could have reached those level of understanding and emotions and empathy if I hadn't have been willing to work on that stuff. At the end of the day, I heard Sandy Beach say in his talks, and I'm from Tampa, so Sandy was all around in that area. I got to meet him a few times before he passed. But I remember he would start off with talks with saying, at the end of the day, it's what is it like to be you inside of you? And I get up in the morning and I ask myself that. What is it like to be me inside of me? And that keeps me focused on doing my prayer, doing my meditation, taking care of my self-care. But it also helps me audit. I've heard a lot of people in here saying, it's not into thinking, it's into action. And that's true. It also talks about our old ideas availed us nothing. And I have learned that I am not the thinker, through my meditation practice. And so I do have some agency over my thoughts. A thought can come in. It doesn't mean it's real. But if I start expanding on it, or if I get a resentment against somebody and I'm starting to calculate how I'm going to get them back or show them how they hurt me, I'm living in hell. And it's no fun to live in hell. I've heard this a million times. You're letting that person live rent free in your head. I heard that for 5 years. I had no idea what that meant. I got to be totally honest. I had no idea what that meant. Now, today, I know what that means. Just to give an example of my week this week, I talked to my sponsor, sponsees. Somebody texted me on a Thursday night saying their topic leader had canceled on them for Friday night. Would I cover? And I, sure. If someone asks you to do something in AA, you say yes if it's a legitimate, deal. And I pull into this place. I'd never been to it before. I pull into it. It was probably twice as many people. Same size room, but it was huge. I was a little intimidated at first, but then I realized, I'm just, my temper reminded me, I can't screw it up. Just bring a topic, what was bothering me that day. And, it was a great meeting, and I had a good time. Before I came down here, to give an example of what it was like, before and what I thought my life was going to be like. And you've probably heard this a million times. Oh, if I would have, you know, wrote a list of what I wanted when I came into AA, I would have sold myself short. That has been my experience 100%. Before I came down here, I got a 21-year-old, a 19-year-old, and a 17-year-old wife. And I was doing some work. I sent out a text to say, hey, I'm going to make coffee. Who wants coffee? This is at 5 o'clock. My wife, my 21-year-old, made coffee at 5 o'clock. Yeah. That would have never happened. We probably would have been drunk, fighting with each other, blaming each other, pissed off at each other. We had coffee at 5 o'clock, and I feel good. And I was excited to come down here. Walker, I would have never found this place if you hadn't, if Tim hadn't announced you were doing your story. Lisa, thanks for asking. Thank you for your service tonight, and I appreciate everybody. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom, with the snaggy shirt. Thank you again, Tom, and thank you, Lisa, for the opportunity to be of service. I've asked Lisa to come pass out the chips, because, yay. Yeah. Because when somebody asks you something, then you can't say no.
If you want to join our way of life, we offer you a white chip, or come back from research. Okay. Coming back? Anybody have 30 days for that drink? Yeah. 60 days? Year tonight. Amazing. She listens to me on a daily basis, and that is a job in itself. She just puts so much into me every single day, and I don't think I would be as far as I am without this one right here.
Which I know. Oh, I'm Stephanie, and as I told you before, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Stephanie!
How did I do it? I'm glad you asked that. I'm an old IBM, or I used to work for IBM, and we used to use a lot of acronyms. So I came up with an acronym to keep me on track, and it's RACS. I had to recognize that I had a problem. I had to acknowledge that it was a problem. I had to plan to get rid of the problem and stick with it.
Yeah.
It works.
Hi, my name is Christine. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi. Hey,
hi. We're here.
Yes, we are.
We did it. 365 days ago, I met her. And she's been a pain in my butt and a thorn in my side ever since. I must have kicked her out of her house like 3 times. She kept coming back. She kept fighting with me. And she ventured out and went on her own. And she's working a very good program. And I couldn't be more proud of you, Sean.
God.
What's your name?
I'm Shine. I'm alcoholic.
Hey, Shine.
I became willing to stop being so willing to do what I thought I wanted. I put my will aside and started working his. And I worked a program with people who wanted to see me succeed, and I didn't want to disappoint them. That baby right there. She said she kicked my ass, she lived with me. And I stayed dedicated in a way that I didn't think I could, because it works when you work it.
There we are. We got one more. We got one more. Abby, come on. Here we are again. Here we are again.
How you doing?
Hi, my name is Misty, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Abby is very special. She's a very, very, very special firecracker.
Little people power.
Abby's a fighter. I'm not going to tell her story. I'm going to let her tell it. Abby is the perfect example of coming into these rooms, being determined, doing things she didn't want to do, but did what was suggested of her. You know, she's one of the most beautiful humans I know.
I love you, Abby.
Oh, wait a minute. Here, yeah, there's that one, but then I got you.
Oh, my God.
So.
Abby,
I'm
out.
Hey, Abby.
This is Lauren. Not giving up. Praying every morning, every night, thanking God. Surrounding myself with people that love me, positivity. Always helping the next addict and alcoholic every single day. Never forgetting where I was when I first came back into these rooms. And just staying humble. I appreciate all y'all. Love y'all so much.
Certainly enough, but I'll say this after watching that. Biggest thing is learning how to love and be loved. That's something I've had to learn in the AA as well. Forget that. That's what's going on here.
How many?
14.
Oh, yeah.
Promise that you're twisting in the wind.